some people who are here have been here before, and others have just waited till today when the question is peace possible? I'm thinking, oh, let's get in and get the answer to that, and then we've got it all. Well, as some of you have heard, one of the goals, or the goal that I have in leading interfaith trips out to the Middle East is to try to help people come back a little less certain than when they went out. And so maybe that's also a goal for answering that question. If I were to answer it with a sentence, is peace possible? And we're talking now about, I'm afraid Pastor Nancy misled some of you because there's Afghanistan and Iraq mentioned, I think there were, Pastor Nancy suggested we were going to do all that today, Afghanistan and Iraq. And really, the reference is to Afghanistan and Iraq because the wars there have implications and have impact on the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict and vice versa. So we're not going to deal with Iraq and Afghanistan in a direct way. But in terms of the question, is peace possible, that is Arab, meaning Arab state, Israeli-Palestinian peace possible, my one-sentence answer to that would be, yes, peace is possible. Getting there is not easy. But, I think 15 years ago, and any longer than that, the question of whether peace is possible, you'd have to give a much more ambiguous answer to it, and it would only be a sort of based on a vision or a hope. And when I say yes, I'm basing that on some developments that have occurred in the last 10, 15 years that make me confident that peace is possible. But there are also developments in the last 10, 15 years that make me sure that getting there is not easy. What we're going to do today is to look at really the era of three U.S. presidencies and the ups and downs of getting to peace during those years. And we're going to end today with the current situation, at least as I view it, and where are we as an American public in relationship to the prospects? Because that does, after all, have something to do with it. I mean, where we are as a people, how interested we are in this, how we're interested, how we go about supporting or encouraging or not the prospect of peace, certainly has something to do with whether it will happen. So the three presidencies are pretty clearly are Clinton, from 1992 to 2000, President George W. Bush, from 2000 to 2008, and then most recently, and for the shortest time, Barack Obama. It's interesting to me, as those of you who were here yesterday, I made a pretty strong case that the Cold War framework of U.S. foreign policy, which divided the world into communists, anti-communists, and did that, I think, in a way that inevitably was simplistic and distorted the way the world is and the way the Middle East is. And then I said, there's a new framework now since 9/11, and that's the war against terrorism, and that has a similar effect on our policy, sort of simplifies and distorts our view of the region, in particular, in that case, the Middle East. It's interesting that the parties got closest to peace during the years between when the Cold War ended, 1989 or so, and when the war on terrorism became the new framework after September 11, 2001. I could say, see, that makes my point. Well, in a certain sense, it does. And I'll talk a little bit about what I mean by the parties got the closest during those years. We've made reference, of course, to the Oslo process, which was quite extraordinary. And I've encouraged people to read this book, The Process, by Uri Sevier, because it really is, from an Israeli point of view, the Israeli chief negotiator at Oslo, it really tells the political and the human story of negotiations between the PLO and Israel, which led to the Oslo Declaration signed on the White House lawn on September 13, 1993. As that declaration was signed, of course, it wasn't a treaty, it wasn't a peace treaty, it was a declaration of principles and intentions and set out a process by which the parties would then negotiate forward toward a peace agreement. One of the, I think many people believe in hindsight, one of the mistakes of it is it didn't explicitly refer to two states. It seemed to imply that's where the negotiations would lead, but it didn't say that. And in fact, the United States had not, up until then, said that we supported the creation of a Palestinian state. Some other countries had. And to his credit, it's one of the things that George H.W. Bush did when he was in office. He was the first U.S. president, wasn't Clinton, to declare support, U.S. support, for a Palestinian state next to Israel, a state in the West Bank and Gaza. West Bank, that place where you see the X's, Gaza here. Obviously, there's a space in between the two, and we can talk about that at a point. During the process, after the declaration was signed, and the parties then set up a procedure for negotiating, there were several, and this has been characteristic of this conflict at several points. Maybe this is the 90s are the most dramatic example of it. There were several positive things that happened, but there were also several negative things. So developments went in two directions, toward peace and toward more conflict and violence. You know, there are other situations like that. I mean, I would guess, frankly, that if you looked at Iraq War and Afghanistan, you could look at it and say, well, that's a positive development, and then you go, well, that's a negative development. It's a part of the historical process. What are some of the positives? Well, first, that they signed this declaration, committing them to a peace process and to an eventual peace. Second, this shouldn't be underestimated, the leaders of the PLO, who for decades had lived in exile from the land, that is the PLO leaders, Arafat and all the others, were not in Gaza and the West Bank. This is very different, for instance, from the Vietnamese situation, where the Vietnamese leaders of their liberation movement were on the ground in Vietnam, most in the north, but also in the south. And so fighting a war, struggling a war, they're struggling from inside their people and from the land that they claim independence for. In the case of the PLO leaders, they weren't there. They were in various capitals at various times. For a while they were in Jordan, then the King of Jordan, there were tensions there, and the King of Jordan threw the PLO, then they went to Lebanon. Then during the 1982 war, the PLO agreed to leave Lebanon, and the military went to Yemen, the political leaders went to Tunisia. So for all those years, the leaders of the Palestine Liberation Movement were out, and one of the things the Oslo Agreement accomplished was that they came back in. That's quite dramatic. Arafat was now in Gaza, and also was able to be in the West Bank, as were other PLO leaders. Third thing is that the Palestinians, under the Oslo process, carried out national elections in Gaza and the West Bank in 1996. President Carter had a team of observers out there and made observer's report on the election process. I happened to be out there and participated in a kind of informal way in not part of the thing, but just out there watching, seeing it happen. It was quite extraordinary. The Palestinians were electing their government in the areas of the West Bank where they were allowed at that point, according to the Oslo Agreement, to govern, and also in most of Gaza, even though the Israeli army was still around Gaza and still in parts of it. So they held elections and formed a government. Third, relations began to develop between Israelis and Palestinians based both on the declaration that had taken place, but as much also on the prospect that there was going to be an agreement. In other words, people, before there was a prospect of an agreement, the idea that business people would begin to talk about possible deals, Palestinian business people and Israeli business people, rather, you know, business people don't operate like that. They want to see that there's going to be a context in which if they make a deal, it could possibly work. So with the proceeding of the Oslo process, there were many contacts between Israeli and Palestinian business people to begin to have the basis for economic cooperation. There were also a lot of other contacts. I mean, there are youth groups, youth movements in both Israel and Palestine, including some quite conservative ones in Israel, that is, associated with parties that were more hawkish. Because this process was going on, there would be weekend retreats with Israeli teenagers and Palestinian teenagers. In fact, a friend of mine who's a journalist, David Shipler, tells the story of being invited to speak at one of those and going out there a few days before and finding out that the parents of the teenagers who were getting together were very nervous. They were nervous for two reasons. First, they were afraid that something terrible might happen. I mean, after all, my kids are going off to be with the kids of the enemy. So they're afraid that something terrible will happen. But as he tells it, and I don't think over-dramatizes, they're also afraid that something good would happen. And of course, I mean, teenagers go, and it didn't take teenagers too long before they were listening to music. And you know what can happen then. And that's a marvelous sort of, you know, when you think about it, oh, wow, that's great. Now, it ends at a certain point because the process doesn't succeed. But that kind of thing was going on. Concrete, another example. Jewish Israeli jazz musicians from Tel Aviv were going to Ramallah in the West Bank and sitting in at Palestinian jazz clubs and playing. So there were things happening. There was an environmental group formed of Palestinians, Israelis, and Jordanians. And it's still going. To deal with environmental issues, which obviously don't know these lines that we have between a Palestinian state and Israel, or Israel and Jordan. Environmental issues tend to be regional issues or world issues. One other example of a positive thing that developed during that time, as you can imagine, school curricula, during a conflict, as long as the conflict were going on, were not exactly charitable toward the people on the other side, nor were they objective in terms of the history of the conflict. So if you studied the conflict in an Israeli school, Jewish school, or in a Palestinian school in the West Bank, you studied different versions of the conflict. And the ministries of education of Jordan, Israel, and the PLO, or Palestinian Authority, once there were elections, formed a commission to study the curricula of the three areas to see how the curricula needed to be reformed in light of the coming peace agreement. Again, when the Oslo process broke down at the end of the 90s, these possibilities folded up. That doesn't mean there wasn't some work done and they can't pick them up at some point, but these were all things that happened during the 90s, and because the process finally didn't reach a peace agreement, there's a tendency to only talk about the negative things that happened in the 90s, when in fact there were a number of positive things that happened. Now, what were some of the negative things? Well, interestingly enough, though it certainly contradicted the spirit, though stupidly, I think, in terms of the agreement that was reached, not the letter of the agreement, but the spirit and principles involved in the agreement, Jewish settlements in the West Bank expanded. In fact, during the 1990s, during the Clinton years, the number of Jewish settlers in the West Bank and in Gaza doubled. Well, of course, what that means, I mean, it's pretty simple, isn't it? If you're going to have a Palestinian state here, and the number of Jewish settlers is doubling in that area and growing in Gaza, though not nearly as much, you're taking away the possibility that there's going to be contiguous, all of us, or some of us who study this conflict, learned a new word, contiguous territory, in other words, territory without interruption. If you have Jewish settlements all through there, there are many, many interruptions, and the Israelis also built roads to connect the settlements with each other and with Israel proper, and those roads were limited in access to people with a certain color license plate, Israeli color license plate. So that was a very negative development, very discouraging development to Palestinians, and it happened with great dynamic, and the Clinton administration didn't really do anything effectively to stop it. And by the way, just to say how long that has been an issue, when we first moved to the Middle East in 82, and President Reagan launched his initiative, President Reagan said, freezing Israeli settlement expansion is essential to progress for negotiations to get to peace. President Reagan, 1982. This is President Clinton 15 years later, and nothing effectively was done. You know a little bit about the story about Obama, which is they weren't able to stop the settlements either, although there is now a temporary freeze, a partial temporary freeze, not full freeze. What else went on? Well, there was still violence that went on. Not all the time, but there was violence during the Oslo years. About April of 1993, the agreement signed in September, in April 93, Hamas carried out its first suicide bombing. Well, that's not like John the Baptist bringing Jesus, you know, it's sort of the opposite. I mean, it's not a good signal. The first violence after the agreement was signed was against Palestinians, and it was carried out by a man by the name of Baruch Goldstein, who had moved to Israel from Brooklyn, lived in a big settlement near Hebron in the West Bank by the name of Kiryat Arba. And this guy, Baruch Goldstein, extremist, went to the mosque right near Abraham's tomb when Palestinians were at prayer, I think it was a Friday, but there were many Palestinians there, and with a machine gun, murdered 29 Palestinian Muslims praying and wounded 40 or 50. And that happened about 3 or 4 months after the Oslo Agreement was signed. Later that spring, now we're into 1994, there were 3 Hamas suicide bombings, which killed 50, 60 Israelis and wounded many more. So, obviously, negative. To just mention one more positive, because I've said now 1994, in spring of 1994, Jordan and Israel signed a peace treaty. And what that reflected was that Jordan, which had always been very cautious about doing things on its own, it would never do the kind of bold thing Egypt did. I said this yesterday, that Jordan's a small country. It's got to be aware of its big neighbors. But because the PLO was now negotiating peace with Israel, King Hussein felt empowered to begin his own negotiations with Israel. And because the issues between Israel and Jordan were relatively simpler, they were able to reach an agreement, and they signed it, so they had a Jordan-Israel peace treaty, and that happened in 1994. But the two negative things, the two biggest negative things, were settlement expansion on the Israeli side and Hamas, more Hamas than Fatah, but Palestinian violence against Israelis the other way. Third thing that was negative was the pace of negotiations. It was frustratingly slow. And slow, not just in terms of the process of agreements, but slow in terms of producing changes on the ground that people could feel, see, and live each day, so that they could say, I can see peace coming by the way my daily life is changing for the better. And that didn't happen. It happened to some extent, but it certainly didn't happen fast enough. It's interesting. The biggest blow, clearly the biggest blow to the prospects of peace during the Clinton administration, was the assassination of the Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin. Yitzhak Rabin, who had been the hero of Israeli wars against the Arab countries when there were such wars, a tough guy, had made a commitment and made a decision, apparently, I mean, by all evidence, had made a decision that it was in Israel's strategic interest to get to a peace agreement with the Palestinians, and that would mean a two-state solution. It took him some time to get there, but when he was there, he was pretty clear about it. He also, there's some evidence to suggest that he was worried that the process was going too slowly, and in fact, evidence for that view of Prime Minister Rabin is that he and Arafat, a few months before Rabin was killed, appointed two of their very close-in people, close-in political people, on the Palestinian side, Mahmoud Abbas, interestingly enough, who's now, of course, the president of the Palestinian Authority, and Yossi Beilon, who was the justice minister in Prime Minister Rabin's government, to head up informal, quiet talks about how to resolve the what are called the final status issues, which is borders and security arrangements, the settlements issue, refugees, and Jerusalem. These are tough issues. In its wisdom, or stupidly, you can say, either make a case either way, I think, the Oslo process said these issues will only come up at the end. The theory was that you had to build up enough trust by making certain progress on the ground so that people would be willing to consider the compromises that would be involved in these very emotional issues. But apparently, Rabin and we assume Arafat, because they agreed on this, were nervous that these issues were such volatile, important issues, and the process was going so slow that they wanted to begin talking. And so they set up these groups to talk informally. I took a group, in fact, the same time when I was out there for the elections in 96, I invited American Muslim Jewish Christian leaders, about 15, 12, to come out during that period. And what we did for several days is go around and talk to people who were either in those talks or close enough to the talks to tell us what was going on. And it was interesting that the members of our delegation, Americans now, were quite surprised to hear at how much progress was being made in those informal talks toward agreements about how to resolve refugees, Jerusalem, settlements, and borders and security. And I just remember some of the people in the delegation, including a very prominent Orthodox, American Orthodox rabbi, who happened to be Joe Lieberman's rabbi. He wasn't really his rabbi anymore when he's a senator. I think he bar mitzvahed him, you know. Obviously, it didn't take in the way we'd all like. But that's true of a lot of Christian baptisms, by the way. This rabbi was stunned by the progress that we heard was being made in these talks. Now, it's progress toward ideas that the people involved in the talks believed could be acceptable to majorities on their side for solutions about Jerusalem, refugees, etc. Rabin and Arafat agreed to do this sometime around, maybe in the spring of 95. November 95, Rabin is assassinated. He's stepping down off a huge peace rally in Tel Aviv supporting the Oslo process. I think 100,000 people there. They have just sung this song for peace, Israeli song for peace, and Rabin, in a film, Rabin is shown to be singing it, and he's a lousy singer and doesn't like to sing, but he's singing it too, and he steps down off the platform, and a man comes up and kills him. You know, think of our own history as Americans and what an assassination can do. John F. Kennedy, and we seem to do it more than most countries, or at least as much as many, as any country. John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy. I remember the spring of 1968, within 2 months, April 4, and then June, we lost King and we lost Robert Kennedy, who seemed on his way to become the next president of the United States. So Rabin is assassinated. I remember a Palestinian Muslim American in this interreligious group. He called me and he said, "Oh, Ron," he said, "Rabin has been killed." I said, "I know." He said, "Oh, but you know," he said, "I'm so relieved it was a Jew who killed him."
Oh.
Well, no, I mean, you understand why. I mean, he thought, first when he heard the news, he was sure it was a Palestinian who killed him, and he thought that would be just even worse. But it was a Jew. It was a Jewish extremist who killed Rabin. That was certainly the biggest blow to the peace process. Shimon Peres, who was second to the prime minister, takes over, becomes prime minister. But then there are, in the spring of 96, this happened November 95, in the spring of 96, there are three or four Hamas suicides that kill numbers. I don't have the exact numbers, but 150, maybe 200, and wounded many more Israelis, civilians basically, some soldiers, but basically the suicide bombers blew themselves up near a bus or bus stops and stuff. So it was just awful. And the Israelis were having elections, and guess what? In a certain sense, Hamas elected Bibi Netanyahu, who was who came in those elections. Because in the context of those bombings, Israelis moved to the right, or however you want to say it, moved away from any confidence in the peace process and voted for Netanyahu, who presented himself as being much tougher than Shimon Peres. So and that's in 96. By 99, things have begun to shift back the other way. And in fact, there's a period in 97, 98, where for months, there's no violence between Israelis and Palestinians. And as a result of that, elections that are held in 1999 produce a Labor Party victory. And just generally, you may know this, the Likud is the more conservative coalition, Labor is the more liberal or more peace-oriented, and Ehud Barak is elected to be the prime minister from the Labor Party. So we're now up to, 1999. Ehud Barak comes in. Without going into great detail, I think it's fair to say many Israelis believe that he is rather opportunistic and in some ways not very good at politics. He comes out of the Israeli army, so did Rabin, but that he, in the early months of his prime ministership, he gets himself into various kinds of hot water with various elements of the Israeli polity, Israeli coalition. Israeli governments are parliamentary governments, so they're often made up in ways that you hardly can understand how they could stay together. And Ehud Barak is having various kinds of trouble. And what he decides to do, and because there are further elections coming up, he decides that he wants to end the conflict with the Palestinians. So he decides we need a summit to end it once and for all. In one sense, you can say it was a bold move. In another way, politically, it was a sort of desperate move, because he believed by ending the conflict, he could then win re-election. And he didn't see anything else he could do that was as clear a way to be re-elected as ending the conflict. He comes to President Clinton, who also, this is now, 2000, Clinton is also faced with elections and is clearly going out of office. He's had his two terms. And so Clinton, I wouldn't say he was desperate, but he was certainly interested in having, as one of the last things he did, helping to make peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. So Clinton agrees to host the summit. And this happens in July of 2000, just before our elections. And these are the elections that, when they happen, were quite controversial, but out of a Supreme Court decision, it's decided that George W. Bush is the new president. Clinton hosts the summit. And the summit, is a great deal of, inevitably, expectation and hope around this summit. The leaders of Israel and Palestinian Authority come to Camp David. Obviously, Camp David chosen because of the success that Carter had with Egypt and Israel. The parties come, and there's photography. I don't know if you remember, there's a picture where, I forget how it goes, but it's Clinton and Barack and Arafat, and each one, it's sort of an Alphonse and Gaston scene, where one is trying to usher the other one in the door first, So they meet, and they begin to work on stuff. In the middle of it, it's dragging on. Clinton has to fly off to Japan, I think, for an Asian summit. So you can imagine, presidents are human. The guy is probably exhausted because as he's flying over and flying back, he's on the phone with the negotiators. Comes back, they resume the talks, and finally, it just doesn't work. They can't get agreement. Clinton, of course, Barack blames it on Arafat. Clinton is inclined to blame it on Arafat, too. One of the chief PLO negotiators comes to Clinton just before the press conference at the end of the summit and pleads with him to not to say that we failed here, but rather to say that we came closer than ever to reaching a peace agreement, which objectively is true, that they had come closer than ever to reaching a peace agreement, and the PLO leader advised Clinton to say that the United States will work urgently with the parties to finish the process. Clinton doesn't say that. What Clinton says is blames it on Arafat. And in analysis that has been written, there's a lot written about this summit meeting. I think fairly the analysis of why it failed is more complicated than it was Arafat's fault. Arafat was ambivalent about what he could accept and not accept. Other factors were that the U.S. tended in the negotiations, when you came to a compromise, necessary compromise, the U.S. tended to support the Israeli version of the compromise that was needed rather than the Palestinian one, or rather than a third different than the two positions. And then a third thing that was a factor is that, I referred to this kind of thing yesterday as an element in another kind of critique of U.S. policy, is that there were some issues, particularly Jerusalem, that were not very well prepared. Not very well prepared. A pathetic story. There's a man, a Jewish man, who has devoted the last 25 years to being well informed about Jerusalem. He lives in Jerusalem, and he just follows everything that goes on. He's probably the most knowledgeable person in the world about what's going on in Jerusalem. When just before the summit, the U.S. team of negotiators, three of them, including the chief one, Dennis Ross, come out to Jerusalem, and they call this guy, and they said, could you come to our hotel and brief us on the situation in Jerusalem? This is like a short time before the summit's to begin. The guy says, what am I going to do? It sounds stupid. He said, but I should go, right? So he goes. And they're sitting around the hotel pool with gin and tonics. And that's where the briefing about what to do about Jerusalem takes place. To say the least, this is not adequate to being prepared for negotiations about Jerusalem. Now, all the pressure's on them, excuse whatever you meant, but it's clearly not adequate. So the summit fails. Clinton goes along with Barack, basically blaming it on Arafat, and most things you read blame the failure on Arafat. Bush, in our country, Bush then comes to power, obviously, in January, George W. Bush. And in Israel, there are elections, and Ariel Sharon comes to power. Well, now, Ariel Sharon, the last time he appeared high up in Israeli political life was when he was the Minister of Defense during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, and was the Minister of Defense under which Israeli forces surrounded the refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila, in Lebanon, and allowed the Christian Falangist militia, Lebanese militia, who were, to say the least, deeply hostile to the Palestinians. I mean, hated the Palestinians for a variety of historical reasons. The Israeli forces allowed the Falangist militia to come into the camps and literally from watchtowers that the Israeli army had set up around the camps, watched as the massacres were carried out in Sabra and Shatila. He was actually forced to resign, Sharon was, by an independent Israeli commission. I'm going to read a little bit about that in a part of my memoir on Saturday morning. He was forced to resign, but here he is back, you know, like the Phoenix, back and now is the Prime Minister of Israel. Well, his approach was that he would not talk with Arafat at all. So, no negotiations, obviously. The Palestinians, very frustrated by the failure of the summit, also frustrated and very angry. During his campaign, Sharon makes this trip up to the top of the Temple Mount. If you've been to Jerusalem, you know that there's the western wall of the Jewish temple, the ancient Jewish temple, and then there's a flat part where the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque sit. And Sharon decides to go up on the Temple Mount with a contingent of Israeli troops. And he says he's going to show that we can all be peaceful together in Jerusalem. Well, it had the opposite meaning for Palestinians. It was a kind of another conquering of Palestinian Muslim sites. And as a riot breaks out, stones are thrown, shots are fired. And in the context of all of that, there's a second intifada, a second Palestinian uprising in Gaza and the West Bank. This one with a much greater component of violence than the first one in 1987 and 88. Understandable, perhaps, in terms of what Palestinians were feeling at the time, but in terms both of its political effects on Israel and the process, and in terms of its how damaging it was for Palestinians, it's devastating because, of course, the Israeli army has means to respond to that. That is, you know, much more powerful, much greater. So that's the beginning of the decade of 2001, I'm sorry. Did you tell me? Okay. So George W. Bush. George W. Bush comes in and you know, there was a phrase around at the time he came in that his approach to many issues was anything but Clinton. Let's see, ABC, anything but Clinton. In other words, that any issue you took, he wasn't going to do it the way Clinton did it. And in terms of this particular issue, he made it clear early on in his presidency that this was not going to be a priority issue. So in the beginning of 2001, he makes that clear soon after he comes into office. Now, when we get to September, there are other reasons why it might not be a priority. And the biggest reason, of course, was September 11th. We're talking about the first year of the Bush presidency, September 11, 2001. An event that, you know, was compared with Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor. And in a sense, the comparison is reasonable in the sense that our country had not been attacked since Pearl Harbor. I mean, attacked on our home territory. And if any, we all had some experience, probably we remember, like we remember where we were when John Kennedy was killed. We remember probably something about where we were that day, the images we saw, not only of the planes going into the towers, but then the towers falling. If any of you were in New York, I mean, it was an incredibly traumatic event for our country. That then, of course, leads to a decision by the United States to go to war. First of all, in Afghanistan, where the Taliban were and where Al-Qaeda hung out. So in one sense, I'm not going to say it was the right thing to do, but I'll say there's at least some justification. That's where Al-Qaeda was, and there had been attempts to sort of strike at them, but here was, given that we were attacked, we're going, and we go into Afghanistan full bore, or full bore until we go into Iraq. That is, the bore was fuller until we had another country that we were invading. And I think probably people feel somewhat differently about those two wars, invasions. But then, you know, we go into Iraq. And then we have, so the Arab-Israeli peace process, in one sense, diminishes in its size in context of these other things that are happening, which seem, and in one sense, are larger. And, of course, our troops are involved directly, where they're not in the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So a couple of things about how the conflict relates, how the two are related. First is, it's interesting that even though these other wars are going on, Afghanistan and Iraq, that there are developments in the region related to the Arab-Israeli conflict that are actually positive. For example, in 2002, all of the Arab states, in the form of the Arab League, which is the organization of the Arab states, sign on to an initiative launched by Saudi Arabia called the Arab Peace Initiative, which declares more clearly than Arab states ever had done before their readiness to have full peace with Israel as long as Israel accepts the formation of a Palestinian state in all of the West Bank and Gaza. In other words, that Israel goes back to the 1967 borders, which is what that black line supposedly represents, called the green line it's called the green line, but I didn't want to use the color green because green is sort of a Palestinian color, and I didn't have any blue for the Israeli color, so I didn't want to get any trouble, so I used all black. So the Arab League declares their readiness to make peace with Israel, and they had done something like this as early as 1982 in something called the Fez Declaration, but the Arab Peace Initiative uses the word Israel. The Fez Declaration did not, but says they're ready to make peace with Israel, except assuming that Israel withdraws to the 67 lines and there's a Palestinian state created, and that Jerusalem, the issue of Jerusalem is resolved, the issue of refugees is resolved. That happens in 2002. In 2003, and I've referred to this a number of times, and those of you who were here yesterday took copies of it, the Geneva Accord is announced. When the Clinton summit ended in 2000, in July. After that, Clinton's still in office. He and his team go back to the sort of drawing board, and they come up with what are called the Clinton parameters. Now, the Clinton parameters are ideas for how to resolve the conflict. Interestingly, the ideas are not Clinton's ideas. They are precisely the ideas that came out of the talks that Rabin and Arafat had launched, the secret talks or informal talks, back in 1995. So they're really Israeli-Palestinian ideas. Clinton announces them, gives them to both sides. There's one more round of negotiations, but neither Arafat is prepared to sign on to the tentative agreement, nor is Sharon, who's now in power in Israel, or is then in power in Israel. And so nothing happens, but these ideas are there. What happens next about the ideas is that the Swiss government, like the Norwegian government, small, can't impose its will, but it might be able to do some things that help. So the Swiss government invites prominent Palestinians and Israelis to come to Switzerland and begin a process to negotiate based on the idea, these Israeli-Palestinian ideas for compromises. And they do that over a period of two and a half years, and by December 2003, they're ready to announce something called the Geneva Accord. As I said, I gave out copies of it yesterday. So if you haven't, you might want to pull that out, because that is, even still today, basically the outline of what a peace agreement would look like. And here are the following key elements. By the way, what I have is a summary of the Geneva Accord. If you go online, you can Google Geneva Accord, you can find a much more detailed thing. It's an actual peace treaty, so it goes on for, 60 or 70 pages with all the detail. But in this summary, and I think the summary is basically accurate, here are some of the key points. Affirming their deep belief that the logic of peace requires compromise and that the only viable solution is a two-state solution based on UN Security Council Resolution 242 and 338. we also talked about that resolution, which calls for Israeli withdrawal from the territories it occupied in the 67 war, namely the West Bank, Gaza, the Sinai from Egypt, and Golan from Syria. Of course, the Sinai has now been returned to Egypt when they made their peace. Affirming that this agreement marks the recognition, this is interesting too, of the right of the Jewish people to statehood and the recognition of the right of the Palestinian people to statehood. They use the same language for both peoples. And that's important. I'm sure that took some hard bargaining because from the Palestinian point of view, there's some reluctance to acknowledge Jewish right of statehood there. That's part of why they rejected the creation of Israel. Furthermore, declaring that this agreement marks the historic reconciliation between the Palestinians and Israelis and paves the way to reconciliation between the Arab world and Israel. So this piece of the document is saying, now that we've got this ironed down, Israeli-Palestinian peace, this opens the possibility of all Arab states in the region having peace with Israel. And of course, that's parallel to what I said was the Arab League position. Then it says, the return of Israel to the pre-67 borders. This means that Israel would get out of all of the West Bank and all of Gaza. When it says, the return of Israel to the pre-67 borders now, with minor border modifications, including the trade of land on a one-to-one basis. And that involves the settlements. Many of the settlements, as many as 70% of Jewish settlers who are living in the West Bank, live in settlements pretty close to the 67 line. So the idea is that at least some, of those settlements would be incorporated into Israel. And when you do that, obviously you're taking land from the Palestinian state. And what this is saying is that there would be a one-for-one trade of land where some land would be incorporated into Israel. Israel would give land to the Palestinians, for instance, down here on the south end of the West Bank, or maybe next to Gaza, on a one-to-one basis. Israel will withdraw settlers from the Palestinian areas. It doesn't say all settlers, because obviously these settlers, right along here, would be in Israel once if the line is adjusted. But there are many settlements, less, 30% or so, out in the outlying areas of the West Bank, closer to the Jordan River, where the settlers would have to be removed or would voluntarily leave because of economic incentives and so forth. Israel and Palestine will establish cooperative security measures, disband all non-government armed bands. A multinational force will be established. This is interesting that there would be a multinational force that would help secure this agreement. It doesn't say where it would be posted. It may be in the treaty itself. Jerusalem will become the capital of both states. The Temple Mount and East Jerusalem will be under Palestinian control, and the wall and West Jerusalem, this is a very interesting, and sometimes people say, boy, there's one for the book. Here we go, this is the Western Wall, in other words, the wall that is the wall of the ancient Jewish temple. Here's the Dome of the Rock, here's Al-Aqsa Mosque, and what this agreement is saying is that the front will be Israeli under Israeli sovereignty, the top will be under Palestinian authority. Well, the logic of that is that the Western Wall is part of the Jewish temple of ancient times, so clearly Israel's not going to want to grant sovereignty to some other party on that. And the top has Al-Aqsa on it, which is the second or third holiest place in Islam, so they're not going to give that to Israel. So that's the arrangement. Now, people say, shoot, that's a mess. And, well, in fact, this guy Nabil Shah, the PLO leader that Kevin and I happen to know pretty well, once said, the situation in Jerusalem in terms of making an agreement is so complicated. He said, you're going to have a GPS device on your shoe to know whether you're in Israeli-controlled Jerusalem or Palestinian-controlled Jerusalem. And we laugh at it, but what they're trying to do is resolve this issue, you know? And so you have to sort of work around the realities that there are, for instance, in Jerusalem, Jewish neighborhoods and Palestinian neighborhoods. Well, the logic of the agreement, or the logic that went in the agreement, is that the Palestinian neighborhoods will be Palestinian sovereignty. The Jewish neighborhood will be Israeli sovereignty. That's complicated, it's messy, you need a GPS device, but try to think of some other solution, you know? And then, I mean, for instance, you can say, well, all the Palestinians should leave. Oh, that's nice, you know? So it's a solution based on certain realities. Anyway, so that's Jerusalem. And then refugees will be compensated, these are Palestinian refugees, although it's interesting, I'm not sure what the treaty says. You know, there were Jewish refugees from Arab countries. When Israel was being created, obviously it became uncomfortable for Jews who were living in Syria or Egypt. Well, understandable. I mean, it's one thing to be a Jew living in Cairo when there's peace or when there's no war, but when there's a war going on between Egypt and the creation of Israel, if you're a Jew in Egypt, it's probably uncomfortable. And so most of those Jews fled to Israel or outside. So I'm not sure what it refers here to the refugees, whether it's referring only to Palestinian refugees. But in any case, what it says is, refugees will be compensated both for loss of property and for their refugeehood. They can be resettled, this is obviously Palestinian, can be resettled in Palestine. In other words, Palestinian refugees would have a right of return to Palestine. Not a right of return to where they came from, if they came from inside what is now Israel. In other countries, or they have a right to be resettled in other countries who agree to accept them. For instance, I mentioned yesterday that Canada agreed, this is some years ago, and I think probably would still stand today, to accept 250,000 Palestinian refugees. And they can come back in Israel, and some number can come back in Israel at Israel's sovereign decision, though it is not mandated to do so at any particular number. Here, the reference is really the Palestinian refugees who are divided families. In other words, some of them are Palestinian refugees in Lebanon or somewhere else, and they've got family who stayed behind and are now Israeli citizens. So the Israelis in negotiations have suggested that a limited number, and they're not talking, they're talking, 50,000, something like that, no big number, might be allowed to come back in on the basis of family reunification. So these are all points in the agreement. The last one is release of all Palestinian prisoners from Israeli prisoners over the course of the next 30 months after the governments agree to the accord. There are thousands of Palestinian prisoners being held by Israel. As you know, there's a fair amount of attention on one Israeli prisoner being held by Hamas named Gilad Shalit. And in fact, negotiations, when I had a group out there in December, were going on that was talking about the release of some hundreds of Palestinian prisoners in exchange for Gilad Shalit. And some would say, well, that seems bizarre. What it is the other side of the fact that when Israelis and Palestinians fight, the number of Palestinians killed is usually 10 or more times the number of Israeli Jews killed. So when you're talking about deaths in battle, the number of Palestinians is much higher. When you talk about release of prisoners, the number of Palestinians is much higher in any kind of exchange. So that's the Geneva Accord. It was released in December 2003. Again, while the war in Iraq is starting up, the war in Afghanistan is going full tilt. And polls that were taken among Israelis and Palestinians for the next 2 or 3 years showed that somewhere between, depending on the moment when the poll is taken and how the question is phrased, somewhere between 55 and 65, sometimes as high as 70%, of Israelis and Palestinians said that they could accept an agreement along these lines. So that's a piece of good news. That's why when I answered the question in the beginning, is peace possible, I said yes. And obviously some of the things I'm talking about help to explain why getting there isn't very easy. All right, well, I'll wrap this up. I'll wrap it up this way. Barak, and I said this yesterday, but I think it's worth repeating because it's where we are right now. Barack Obama campaigned on the idea that this issue was a priority. He also, by the way, campaigned, as you know, on the proposition that the Iraq war was wrong. I believe, and to me this is encouraging, that part of the reason he defeated Hillary Clinton in the primary was precisely his position on Iraq. Wasn't the only reason. I mean, there's a long discussion about Barack versus, Obama versus Hillary Clinton. That gets complicated, and the whole business of race and gender come in very much. But I think one of the reasons why he was favored by at least liberal Democrats was that he took a principled position against the Iraq war. And Clinton, as you know, supported it, at least at the beginning. So Obama comes in saying, this is a priority issue. He, in the first weeks of his presidency, he announces an appointment of George Mitchell to be the negotiator. He has consistently, not always loudly, not maybe enough, but he has stayed with that commitment that this is a priority issue. He he got into a hot water, I mean, a tense situation with the Prime Minister of Israel because he was insisting that the settlement stop, and the settlements were going ahead. As a result of U.S. pressure, I think there's no other reason for Netanyahu to do this, because his politics are not oriented in a direction to stop the settlements. Netanyahu agreed to a 10-month partial freeze of settlements. What he agreed to was freeze settlements that were expanding in the West Bank. He did not include East Jerusalem. Did not include East Jerusalem. In a religious coalition I work for, said all of it, East Jerusalem and the West Bank settlements should be halted, frozen, as part of getting the process going for negotiations. But Netanyahu said settlement freeze for 10 months. That expires in September. As Mitchell was trying to get talks going between Israel and Palestinian Authority, he decided that they weren't going to go to direct talks. They weren't going to come face-to-face talks. So he developed this idea, which is an old diplomatic idea, of proximity talks where Mitchell goes back and forth between the two sides. They might be in the same hotel or something, but they're in proximity with each other. They're near each other, but they're not talking directly. The Arab League supported that process, but said it would judge whether that process was making any progress by September. So we're looking ahead now. This is July, August, September. September, the Israeli temporary freeze expires, and the Arab League decides whether there's enough progress in the proximity talks to continue to support them. In that context, where are we as a people? What are we doing? What are we urging? What do we see as key issues? How are we working with each other or against each other? In our different communities, Jewish, Christian, Muslim. So that's, to me, tomorrow, that's what we're going to look at. How can we work together? And obviously, on this issue, it isn't always easy because people have strong connections, real connections, to people on different sides of the conflict, and therefore, one side's version of what's going on is oftentimes the version that the supporters of that side also take up. So we'll look tomorrow at that. I've got some materials related to that, and if any of you, particularly if you're leaving and not going to be here tomorrow, I think where are we tomorrow at 10:50? So if any of you are leaving in the morning, not going to be at the session, you might want to pick it up. If any of you want to read overnight, get prepared, you know. You come and pick up. There are two or three pieces of material here that I think you'll be interested to see, including, just came out before we left Seattle, a couple-page thing from the Jewish peace groups, American Jewish peace groups, saying, here are the 10 no's that conservative American Jews and Israelis say about peace. No, you can't have, there's no partner on the other side. No, the Palestinians can't be trusted. No, this, and the... These are a set of answers or responses to those no's. And in fact, what they're talking about is turning these no's into yeses. And you might want to pick up that. So if you're interested in picking up things on your way out, either because you're leaving or because you want to study, because tomorrow's test, you know, you want to be ready. Thank you.